The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
I'm on the phone with Josh Rogers and Jeremy Epstein. Josh Rogers is founder and CEO of Arete Wealth Management. He also, I should say, will be on the cover of the September edition of the magazine. He's our cover profile for his work at Arete Wealth Management, and in a quite a interesting and decorated background. But he's also managing member of Crypto Futura Fund, a cryptocurrency hedge fund, which is managed day to day by our other guest, Jeremy Epstein, who is co-chief investment officer of the hedge fund, which invests in a diversified portfolio of cryptocurrencies with a market cap of greater than $500 million. The two men are also, incidentally, former roommates at Johns Hopkins University. This may never have come to pass if not for having spent time together as students at Johns Hopkins. And we welcome all of you listeners to the program. And gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thrilled to be here.
So cryptocurrency, volatility maximus, the preferred exchange of drug dealers, criminals, thugs. You know, Vladimir Putin is talking about creating a cryptocurrency for Russia so that he can circumvent U.S. sanctions. And yet cryptocurrency is completely fascinating to so many investors these days. And I might say that all the things I just mentioned can be done with regular money by and large. I mean, drug dealers deal in regular paper currency as well, or just traditional electronic transfers of dollars or Deutschmarks or what have you. But there's this really interesting future, potentially a future. Some people don't buy it. I remember JB Diamond just basically poo-pooing it. And now JP Morgan is working on its own strategy for that. So what I want to start by asking you guys is this, because investors are listening to this program. And I think the question for them is, what place would cryptocurrency occupy in an investor's portfolio? What place would it occupy?
This is Josh. I think I'll maybe take that one first. This same question was actually asked earlier this year, kind of at the beginning of the year at the TD Ameritrade National Conference down in Orlando, Florida, and at the main stage event. And a very noted and kind of well-known large RIA personality in the investment space, Rick Edelman, was on stage. And when asked that question, you know, he basically said that, he was initially skeptical about cryptocurrencies and about Bitcoin, but upon, you know, actually learning more, reading more, and really basically having a better understanding, he was of the opinion that every investor, regardless of their net worth, would do well to have at least 1% of their investable assets allocated into cryptocurrency of some kind, or perhaps a diversified portfolio of cryptocurrencies. To kind of add to that concept, there's actually kind of an interesting statistical, rule of thumb in the angel investing world and the venture capital world, which is, if you think about it, is pretty self-evident, which is something along the lines of, if let's say you have an investment and the upside potential in that investment was, you know, a 9% return or 8% return, then there's a certain threshold of the statistical likelihood of that investment working out according to plan where it makes rational sense to do it. So for example, if an investment is going to only yield, you know, a little bit above the 10-year treasury, then you should probably have about a 90% likelihood or confidence index level that the investment is going to in fact perform that way in order for it to make rational sense. If it's a 9% return, probably maybe let's call it like a 70% chance of likelihood of success. But let's say, for example, that you have an investment that has the potential for 5,000% returns. So what likelihood does that need in order for it to make rational sense to invest in? And the answer to that question is, if you have that much upside, you only need about a 5% chance of it working in order for it to make sense. Particularly, of course, this then depends too on how much you allocate. So now bring it back to Rick Edelman's point about 1%. So in the case of cryptocurrency, if we're just at the very nascent stages, if we're kind of right now in, you know, if cryptocurrency and blockchain is Internet 3.0, and we are kind of in the early years of, let's say, if Internet 1.0, so think circa 1995, and there's the potential for 5,000% appreciation, does it not make sense to at least invest 1% of one's portfolio into this? If you lose, if it turns out it's all completely just a mass delusion, and this whole thing is a mass delusion of many, many of the smartest minds in the world since that was created all the way back in 2009, and then your 1% investment goes to zero, then you've only lost 1% of your portfolio. So that, well, by the way, that just happened like yesterday with China trade war news, right? So, and that happens on a day-to-day basis. And but on the difference there is that if it turns out that this is not a mass delusion, which I think it's safe to say it is not, then clearly with something with that big of an upside potential, it absolutely makes rational sense to have at least 1% of your portfolio. If anything, that's kind of almost laughable to have only 1% of your portfolio. In fact, I would make a very strong argument that it should be much higher than 1%. But what we're trying to say to people is at least start with 1% at this stage.
So Mike, I think you now, we all can hear why Josh is your cover profile for the next month, given his, the way he thinks about things. I look at it a little bit differently, which is, you know, I've spent the last 25 years just deep in the middle of successive technological disruptions. I started my career in .com. I was in social media, head of marketing at a company that went from 20 million to a 1.8 billion valuation in 4 years. I've been in crypto for four years. I got my first Bitcoin at $80. So I've been watching a lot of these waves early and see how they grow. And this one looks very similar to me, because if you think about what Bitcoin and what cryptocurrencies represent, is they are the second half of the internet equation. What the internet did is it allowed for information to move at speeds that were previously unimaginable. And now, and 10 years ago, for the first time ever, we have solved the problem of how do you move items of value across the world with the same degree of speed without the need for intermediaries, without the need for third parties, and to do it in a way that guarantees the safety and security of the system. This is digital money to complement the whole digital world that we live in. And I think there are a couple key points. It was interesting to me that you started off with the negatives about the perception of crypto as a haven for drug dealers. There was a study released by MIT last week that analyzed Bitcoin transactions, saying that approximately 2% of all the transactions are criminal related. We can post those in the show notes if you want. And you compare that to the $250 billion that Danske Bank laundered out of the, you know, former or whatever from Russia. You know, I think it's kind of, it's a good story, but it doesn't really hold much water. I would instead point to people who don't live in the U.S. and don't live in advanced Western democracies, because it's really difficult for investors here to understand what it's like to live in Argentina that had 50% inflation in March. Talk to people in Turkey and Sudan and Cyprus and Zimbabwe and China even. Why is this the greatest thing ever? That there are literally people I know who will die trying to bring cryptocurrencies to the people because they don't trust central banks and they don't trust their centralized government. And when you look at this global phenomenon, this is the first global money opportunities, the first truly global value opportunities. once some of these issues get addressed, this is like the 56K dial-up modem phase. And I'm coming to you, Mike, and I say, hey, I know right now you're doing the AOL, you've got mail thing, but one day you're going to be able to sit on your couch and stream any episode of Friends that you can imagine anytime you want. And oh, by the way, you can then take it into your car if you're interested. And you'll say, psh, that'll never happen. And I'm telling you, no, no, no. The innovation part is done. Now we're on the engineering part. So Josh is providing you the objective, rational investor perspective. And I think I totally agree with him, of course. But I want the people listening to take a step back and put this within a historical context of the innovation here was only possible about 10 years ago because we didn't have the infrastructure. There's a huge, huge demand for it globally. And we're at the very early stages of this, which is why, you know, 2 years ago, I went to Josh and I said, hey, man, there's a huge opportunity here. We need to look at a way to help your clients get a little bit of exposure to this, because this is potentially one of the great asymmetric opportunities that's going to come across most people's desks in their lifetime.
Right. Well, now let me be clear that I was being, you know, somewhat fanciful during the introduction. I do consider cryptocurrency to be a really fascinating and interesting, new event that's come on the scene. And by all means, the whole idea of decentralization and being able to cut out the middleman, being able to increase the velocity of money, all of these things are tend to be very positive. I'm with you on that.
I'm just giving you a hard really, time. I understand it. Don't worry.
No,
the perception is for criminals, and it's just, you know, the story's great, but the reality doesn't hold up. And I think it's important for people
to understand that. And that's exactly what I knew you guys would explode that myth. So here's the thing. What is cryptocurrency really other than an investor opportunity? Now, you've already kind of started down that path, Jeremy. And when I was talking to you, Josh, for the cover profile, it's clear that both of you see this as a revolution. This is not just about making money. It's about actually changing the world, particularly underlying technology of blockchain. That this is, Josh, the way you put it was Internet 3.0. So cryptocurrency, to begin with, how many different cryptocurrencies are there?
Well, I think
it's
important.
Dozens or are there hundreds?
There are hundreds, but I think there's a couple key nuances that it might be worth just highlighting. So there, we call it a crypto asset. So this is a new asset class. Within those crypto assets, there are different types of vehicles. Cryptocurrencies for the means of payment is certainly one of them. But there are things like crypto collectibles, for example, which are unique gaming tokens. Or imagine, like, you can definitively prove that you have the only Mickey Mantle baseball card on the planet. You can't do that with a piece of paper. You can do that with a digital item represented on a blockchain. Crypto securities that will give you the opportunity to have micro ownership stakes in, you know, real estate in the south of France. You can prove that you are the owner of 0.2% of a house if you want to. Crypto back loan mechanisms, smart contracts. So the opportunity, so that's number one. The second thing is, sorry, I don't mean to get like aggressive. I just get very excited sometimes about the other thing that I think is more important than even cryptocurrencies, or crypto assets, which can revolutionize the way that assets and value are transferred, is just like we saw with Amazon versus Barnes & Noble or Netflix versus Blockbuster, we have opportunity for totally new business models to be created. I know three people who are living in Berlin right now, but they are working for what's known as a decentralized autonomous organization. There's no chairman of the board, there's no CEO, it's an entire globally 500 people in 45 countries that collectively by voting manage the assets of this organization, assign tasks to people and pay them through smart contracts and the blockchain and cryptocurrencies. You know, there's a proof of concept was executed in Sri Lanka to provide climate change or weather-related events insurance to Sri Lankan rice farmers, where if the amount of rainfall in a given district went above a certain amount, the money was automatically released and allow these farmers to avoid going, you know, having all of their money gone for that season, which in Sri Lanka is the difference between making it to the next year and having to sell your children into like the sex trade. So these are models that you can't do, you know, micropayments where, you know, you don't have it. 30% of your premiums for insurance go to back office. You don't have any of that in a decentralized environment, and you cannot do that with the existing system. So we're going to see micropayments, new types of business structures, new types of trading mechanisms. There are all types of ways that you're going to be able to seamlessly, for example, trade that ownership stake in that French Riviera house for like a baseball card and pay basically no commission on it if both sides of the of the transaction would like to make that trade. Those are things, and 24/7, 365, of course. So that you cannot do with the existing system and near instantaneous settlement, just for good measure. So there's a lot of things that are going to happen as a result of this. And you can say, you can tell I probably spent way too much time drinking the Kool-Aid, but, you know, it's just obvious to me.
Maybe I can.
Well, it's obvious to Josh. I mean, Josh also has bought into this. He's drinking the Kool-Aid. There's a lot of people drinking the Kool-Aid right now. But, you know, one of the things that you pointed out and Josh similarly pointed out is that there have been so many things along the way that we thought were not only, that we thought would never happen. For instance, when will we ever have the bandwidth to actually stream movies into our homes? And yet faster than we thought. When would we, I mean, the driverless car revolution, which isn't here yet, but it's amazing how quickly that has kind of emerged. And one of the things that we do see happening, I kind of wanted you guys to, and I know you have something to add to what Jeremy said, Josh, but as part of the discussion, I also wanted to kind of talk about how the speed with the velocity of technology, the evolution of technology, and how these things are coming to market actually at faster and faster speeds are going to be quite a thing to contend with. Because just keeping up with the innovations and the changes and trying to stay current is going to be quite a challenge. I mean, obviously, we're going to be using artificial intelligence to automate a lot of these sorts of things, but we still need to have a grasp on, although I fear that at some point we're not going to have a grasp, we're just going to just hand it off to the machines and off we go. But there is this whole thing that innovation is just speeding up. The flow of information speeding up, innovation is speeding up, and even social change is speeding up. I think in terms of a real estate retail and developer and how even retail formats and consumer tastes are changing so fast that it's almost like don't build anything that's actually solid state. You need to be able to some kind of flex system that you can change around in a hurry because everything is moving fast. A long lead in though, Josh, go ahead. What were you going to say to add to what Jeremy had just put forth?
Well, so I was just going to add another small angle of the axe, and it relates to a conversation I just had at lunch today with a potential new advisor that is a group that's looking to leave Mass Mutual to come to Arete, and of course somehow he asked me about the Crypto Futura Fund and wanted to talk about blockchain and crypto and it was interesting. I told him a little bit about one of the in the Crypto Futura Fund. One of the things that we try to do is all three of us agreed on this, is that we didn't want to choose the crypto assets in some sort of like a arbitrary or, you know, emotional gut instinct kind of way. We instead obviously want to try to make all of our decision making in an objective, very data driven kind of manner. And so we've been working on perfecting this decision making algorithm. And of course, like any algorithm, there's a series of different types of sort of questions and different ways in which we rate the answers. And one of them, though, that I really like is this idea. It's very Aristotelian, actually. It's essentially this concept. Aristotle had the idea of the telos, which is that each thing has like an end or a purpose to it. And so the question we ask is what is the what is the thing that this particular crypto asset is trying to solve for? People are, right now, we're having a lot of problems with language. Because this is a new technology, we're having difficulty with like how to name and describe things. And our words are causing us to misunderstand how this technology works. So for example, we're using this term that like when we say something like cryptocurrencies, plural, with, you know, with an S on the end, people's minds jump to this idea that like, how can we have 1,000 different types of currency that we're going to pay for things with? It seems too complicated and crazy and chaotic, right? That's not what's going on. So I just tried to describe to him, I said, okay, what was the purpose of Bitcoin? The stated purpose of the Bitcoin white paper by Satoshi Nakamoto in 2009 was, in reaction to the 2008 world financial crisis, was essentially to create a form of digital gold. It was to create a kind of store of value that was completely decentralized, incorruptible, and unmanipulatable by any world power, any central bank, any state actor, any large corporation, etc. And so then we ask ourselves the question, to what extent has that particular, in this case, this crypto asset, to what extent has it achieved its goal, its stated purpose, or the problem that it's trying to solve for? In the case of Bitcoin, to be a uncorruptible and inviolable store of value, our opinion is it's absolutely achieving its goal. You could make us. I mean, it's probably already at full actuality in a lot of ways. You're seeing that even in like say the trading movements of how the price just escalated during the most recent currency manipulation by China, right? So in a lot of ways. So then I explained to him. I said, but let's take another crypto asset that's in our portfolio, Ripple. And in a way, I said, so what's the purpose of Ripple? Well, the problem that Ripple's trying to solve is completely different than the problem that Bitcoin's trying to solve. Ripple is trying to basically disrupt and improve upon the infrastructure of the international wiring system. So for example, like we're all familiar, if you've ever sent a wire internationally between to another country, there's this network called the SWIFT network, which is essentially the underlying plumbing where that banks use to wire money back and forth when there's different currencies involved. And of course, if anyone's ever noticed this, you might ask yourself, why in a world where we have Venmo right now, why in the world do I have to personally walk into my bank teller, sit there for like 45 minutes, fill out all this paperwork, and then I get the privilege of paying an $85 wire fee to send money from New York to Tokyo, right? Well, that just happened to me because we're taking a family trip to Tokyo for Thanksgiving weekend. And it's like, it's crazy. So what Ripple is doing is Ripple is disrupting the SWIFT network and by using a blockchain-based solution. Now, Ripple also is not nearly as decentralized as Bitcoin. It's not trying to solve the same problem. It's trying to solve a different problem. Similarly, Ethereum is trying to solve a different kind of problem. 0x is trying to solve a different problem. Tron is trying to solve a different problem. So what I'm trying to get at here is that each cryptocurrency or crypto asset and its related blockchain, each of them has their own problem or their own thing that they're trying to solve for to make our world better. That's what Jeremy was talking about with all the various different forms of crypto assets. So as people start to become more educated on this and they start to understand, it's actually not a chaotic system at all. It's actually just like in Internet 1.0 and Internet 2.0, we have different technologies that are solving for different aspects of human existence to make it better.
I'll tell you, there was,
you just clarified something for me, because one of the things that I've been questioning with people is the barriers to entry seem to, if you have technical expertise, the barriers to entry are very low, and we're going to have this just ocean of currencies, and how will any of them really become useful? But Josh, what you just said was very enlightening, but you can also enlighten us about this trip to Japan. Satoshi Nakamoto is on the other end of this trip. Are you meeting with the man that everybody says that nobody knows if he really exists or he's a composite figure? I'm really suspicious now that you have
if I was meeting with him or her or they, I wouldn't be able to tell you. Secondly, only Jeremy actually, since he's on the Satoshi Roundtable, really knows, and he wouldn't tell us anyway. So it's
Jeremy
really on the DL.
Jeremy doesn't.
To this day, we still don't know who he is. Is that right? Or has he come out? Do we know whether he is an individual or not? Or
we don't know. We don't
group.
Know.
And, no
and, and we don't know. And at this point, it doesn't really matter. I mean, I think the whole point of this was to help people see an alternative system. And I tell people, if there was any other startup on the planet that had gone from a value of zero to a quarter trillion in 10 years, they would be on the front page of the Wall Street Journal every single day. But that's exactly what Bitcoin has done with basically no marketing. But there's an important point here, because you said with technical expertise, there can be a total wave of crypto assets. And you are 100% right about that. And I would say that's a good thing. And the reason it's a good thing is because it introduces market competition to value. Right now, if you really think about it, there's not a free market for currency. You and I and Josh, we must use dollars at a certain point because the IRS will only take dollars for payment. So we have no choice at a certain point in terms of how we are compensated. What the crypto world says is, no, we are going to let the absolute best, most valuable network win. So the barriers to entry are zero. However, that doesn't mean there will be a million cryptocurrencies. What it means is there'll be a million experiments, and the ones that people find the most value in, as measured by demand for those assets, will be the ones that win. Now, what we're trying to do, and Josh talked about what we call the Crypto Futura Fund value algorithm, is basically say, look, there are 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 types of crypto assets out there today. There are going to be many, many more. That's fine. We're very early in the game. We believe that some of these networks, some of these crypto assets are going to be worth in the capital T trillion dollar range at some point. We could be wrong, of course, but we believe. Now, the challenge is to figure out of those 3,000, which ones will arrive at that trillion dollar level. So what we're doing is we're combining the experience I've had in the last couple years, specifically in crypto and in technology for 25 years, our third partner, Clint, who is one of the world's leading experts on rare earth minerals,
Clint Cox,
yeah. So basically, okay. Clint has spent his whole life figuring out how to value rare physical assets, and we're saying, hey, it's pretty much the same thing, but these are rare digital assets, but the same concept. So we're trying to combine that into this algorithm that allows us to remove more and more of our emotional decision-making and increase the likelihood that we're going to be able to find the proverbial needles in the haystack. It is we are taking a risk. All of our investors understand that. But because of we think the returns could be, this is not a guarantee of future performance, of course, but we believe that the returns on some of these could be just astronomical, and we're going to just do what we can to find them among these, exploding number of assets. And that's basically what we've been doing since inception, and we continue to do. We're playing the long game here, but we believe now that we understand the crypto economic systems and the opportunities associated with them and the permissionless natures of these networks, we see that type of potential, which is why we're going down this path. So hopefully that provides.
What about inflation and interest rates? Let's say a cryptocurrency emerges as the dominant one. It becomes kind of a global currency. What does that mean for inflation? Does this quell inflation? Do we have a much more stable monetary system at that point? And does, here I go, I'm going to ask a compound question now, but does crypto, once it really fully develops, emerges in a big way, the actual currency that we use, will it just nicely coexist alongside the Deutschmark and the yen and the dollar and everything else?
Yes. So I'll take a stab at that. So first of all, there already is a dominant cryptocurrency, and that is Bitcoin. As I'm looking at it right now on my screen, it's a 70% of the total market cap of the entire cryptocurrency, market in general. And as Jeremy pointed out, it's also currently worth $211 trillion. So what I think is going, first of all, I think it's also important for everyone to understand that all currencies currently, even before the innovation of blockchain and the Bitcoin blockchain or any other, currencies have always been in competition with one another. And they've always existed side by side. Furthermore, even in the United States, most of us don't remember, but that we recently heard Fed Chairman Bullard from the St. Louis Fed give a lecture to a large group of one of the biggest blockchain and crypto conferences in New York a couple of years ago, where he actually gave a little bit of history about back in the pre-Civil War era, there were also, in addition to the U.S. dollar, there were like J.P. Morgan banknotes and various different regional banknotes were also highly competitive in terms of which currencies were being used in different sections of the United States versus the U.S. dollar, because obviously there were basically just different levels of trust in different kinds of banknotes. So all of these things, all currencies are essentially a gigantic trust game, if you will. And they all are fluctuating against one another based on the fluctuations that occur in the global political environment and therefore the overall general sentiment of trust. I think where we're headed, and it might be a nice segue to also talk about Facebook's Libra coin, is that I think where we're going is we're going to see an environment where there will be state coins. So, the existing fiat currencies will transform themselves into being digital currencies, which, by the way, they are. There's also an interesting statistic that just came out, which pointed out that the total global monetary supply right now, there's like $60 trillion dollars worth of global monetary supply, but only $5 trillion or something, I forget the exact number, basically an extremely small percentage of it is actually in paper notes. The essentially 95% of all the quote unquote money that exists in the world, it's all sitting on computers basically as like bits. Right? It's all just fantasy, right? I mean, as humans, we've made it all up. So anyway, getting back to my point though, is that we're going to have state coins, then we're going to have corporate coins, which is essentially what Libra is. And then we're going to have the people's coin, which is what Bitcoin is. That is to say, it's not controlled by any state and it's not controlled by any corporation. And these things will all exist in side by side with one another because they all represent the main nodes of power in human existence. Do we trust the government? Do we trust large companies? Or do we trust something that is essentially completely decentralized, that's not controlled by anyone? And those things, and they will oscillate against one another. But anyway, so that's where I think we're headed. And to answer your question, I think that actually will create a more stable global monetary environment.
Yeah, I mean, I think
is there such a thing as interest rates in the cryptocurrency world, Jeremy? Is there such a thing as interest rates? Because we're not, yes. Does cryptocurrency get loaned? Okay, go ahead.
Yes. Well, one thing I just wanted to just get, I know Josh just maybe, he said 211 trillion, I think it was 211 billion on Bitcoin. We're not quite, maybe one day, but I wanted to make sure.
Oh, sorry, you're right.
I know. It was just a miss, but I didn't want anyone to walk away with the wrong.
He said he's playing the long game. Or I think you said he's playing the long game. I think he was projecting a little.
Yeah, well, one day for sure, just maybe not today, by the time you're sorry, Josh, didn't mean to. I'm sure.
No, that was a good catch. Good catch. Sorry.
So yes, there already is an entire emerging what's called DeFi, which is decentralized financial system, where you can go and take your crypto assets and loan them out. And for example, I mean, I'm getting interest rates of 8, 10, 15, 19% on my crypto assets that, I can lock in what's called a smart contract, which is basically a blockchain-based agreement that other people then can borrow or utilize for trading or whatever, and they're obligated to secure that with collateral. So it's already happening. I mean, and the growth of the DeFi market, I can look it up right now, it's closing in on a billion dollars if
you just made the same mistake.
Yeah, I know exactly. You got me thinking. We're thinking so big. We got to keep bringing ourselves back. But this is an industry that basically didn't exist a year ago. So now you have an industry that went from that's going from $0 to $1 billion of decentralized finance with all types of assets being loaned and what have you. So yeah, I mean, I guess the point is everything that you can that exists in the current world will have a blockchain-based equivalent. It'll just be done at orders of magnitude lower cost and significantly lower risk, counterparty risk. And that's just the first part. And then the second part is there will be entirely new markets that are available, which could not, which were literally impossible or are literally impossible given the current structure. You know, Josh told the story about Swift. One of the earliest experiences I had in the crypto world, which helped me sort of realize the potential, is I had two clients who owed me, let's call it $1,000 of expenses. One was in Switzerland. One was in the UK. The Swiss one, of course, wanted to do everything by the book. So they did it with Swift and everything. 3 weeks later, after multiple failures and $71 in fees, I got my $929 in the bank. Meanwhile, the client in the UK sent me a crypto payment and I had it in 10 seconds for 4 cents in fees. And at that point I said, it's game over. Like, and I tell people international, I said, I will only accept payment in crypto. I don't want to deal with the traditional system because it's just too inefficient and too expensive. Why would anyone do that? And once I saw that, I said, it's just a matter of time. This is inevitable. It's just a question of how long it takes.
So a lot of the people listening to this podcast are in the, they're almost entirely in the, investment business. And one of the things that organizations like Blackstone and Apollo Group and others do is to raise funds. What role would a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin have in raising a fund? So for instance, if you're raising an infrastructure fund or a real estate investment fund or a private equity fund, what role would a cryptocurrency play? Does it have a role to play there? Would a completely different cryptocurrency be used for specific efforts of that kind? What do you guys think?
Well, I'll take a stab at it. I think, yeah, so I do think, you know, we talked a little bit earlier, Jeremy gave the example of fractionalized ownership in real estate, and there's all kinds of examples. You know, there's a whole, as you know, I'm really into collecting contemporary art, and there's also a whole series of blockchain-based projects right now going on around not only fractionalized ownership of, you know, very high-end fine art, but then also like using the blockchain solutions to guarantee the provenance of fine art so that, you know, we cut down on the amount of fakes and that sort of thing in the art world. I think similarly, I think, you know, that essentially what we are very familiar with different ways in our business, in the financial services business of, for lack of a better term, securitization. What does securitization mean? It just means that we have different wrappers for breaking down ownership in assets. So, you know, like a 1940 Act mutual fund is one particular wrapper for breaking down ownership across many people in a basket of securities. A publicly registered real estate investment trust is a different kind of wrapper for securitization of a portfolio of real estate holdings. We also, as you know, a lot of the readers of this magazine, your magazine, John, know would be the Reg D space, right? That's just another form. Here we're breaking down ownership in limited partnership units. So I think all of these forms of securitization, right now, if you think about it, they're very, particularly the Reg D space. I think a lot, even the REIT space, Reg A plus, these things are very paperwork intensive. Oftentimes the tax reporting is very cumbersome, particularly on the limited partnership side of things. So I think what will happen is that all these forms of securitization will essentially, the term that's used in blockchain world is tokenization. So we'll move from securitization to tokenization, which really just is another, it's not that complicated. It just means that all these things will turn into like digital assets. So you'll, and for that matter, they'll be more easily transferable, potentially more liquid, and also verification, validation of ownership, it will be much clearer and much easier. And I think potentially also, therefore, like things like reporting and so forth will also get a lot easier around like the valuation of things. So I think that, yeah, I think that would be my sense, is that I think that thing, like a lot of real estate sponsors or people that raise money in the real estate space or other types of hard assets will be moving toward more of a tokenization-based kind of process.
In fact, we have had a couple of pieces in the magazine that on tokenization of securities and assets and so on. So yeah, we have played in that area a little bit, but go ahead, Jeremy.
Yeah, sorry. I'll give you another angle. I mean, I think Josh is totally spot on the tokenization, because that'll, change a lot of the cost structures of fund management, and that'll be great for all the partners. But there's also another angle, like you brought up real estate. Let's say you're running a REIT. Well, now there's a project called Decentraland, which is basically a virtual real estate project secured by the blockchain. So you own a piece of virtual land, but you can prove that you own that. And within that Decentraland, people are actually building virtual reality experiences for people to come in and hang out and play games and all that kind of stuff. Well, I could see a scenario, and there's already a market evolving for various plots of land across this geography, this map, that some are more and more valuable than others. Well, I could easily see a REIT, in fact, I have two blog posts about this, a REIT saying, you know what, we would like to increase our exposure beyond physical real estate to also include digital real estate, but this is not made up digital real estate. Well, it's made up in one sense, but it's guaranteed ownership because we now have the token, which proves we own that. So, you know, you could just increase the range of options that are available to your partners as a fund manager for a REIT, just for example. And I think that could play out against some of your other ones. I mean, I could see private equity guys and all other people starting to look at ways to expand their portfolio by going after some of these crypto assets that are secured by blockchains.
Where are your blog posts? Where do they exist?
I can send you the link. My website, since, you know, for the last 15 years, is Never Stop Marketing. I like to say it's just a mentality as much as anything else, but I have a blog there, and I've got a couple thousand blog posts on how crypto and blockchain might affect, various industries. Gambling would be another one. I just wrote about that the other day, how these decentralized prediction markets will probably upend the entire gambling industry as we know it, because they can do it significantly cheaper and have greater, as a result, there'll be greater payouts for the exact same bet.
Now, you were talking about, you know, virtual property, but one of the things that blockchain, again, the underlying technology for cryptocurrency and other crypto assets, allows a person, especially a person in a third world country, to prove that they own a piece of land. Well, a piece of land that's been taken away by the government, let's say, and even right. even their family members, their the people who survived them, can, through blockchain, prove that this property belongs to us. It was illegally taken away from us by a dictator, a foreign invader, whatever the case may be. So that leads me to one of the other questions I want to ask you guys. What about the democratization of wealth? We've been expecting this to happen in one form or another because of what's going on with the internet and what's going on with the access to information, the access to so many things, that the access to education, so many things that are made possible by the internet or by digital innovations. Does cryptocurrency and assets have a role in blockchain, have a role to play? Because what we're seeing right now is kind of a winner-take-all sort of economy. A lot of people, I think we saw this when we went from the industrial, from the agricultural to industrial revolution. So maybe we're seeing a repeat of this from going from the industrial revolution to the age of information. And it's just going to be the wailing and gnashing of teeth for a while before this thing really starts to pay off in a very broad sense. But right now I'm putting words in your mouth. What do you guys say?
I mean, I would say that, you know, what makes crypto economic systems a little bit different, and I'm not so naive to think that it's going to be perfect and there won't be concentrations of wealth. There definitely will be. I don't know exactly how it'll play out. However, the underlying sort of driver of value within crypto economic systems is network effects. The more people who join, the more value that is created. Now, we've obviously seen network effects in the last 20 years with Google and Facebook and what have you. What's different about crypto is, whereas the value that's accrued as a result of network effects gets concentrated more and more in the hands of Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos and Larry and Sergey, in a crypto economic system, the value gets disseminated to the participants, the contributors, the owners of that network. In order to participate in a network, you must have a token. So as a result, the people who are the owners, which is going to be anyone who's involved, will all benefit as more people get involved and join these networks. So I think there is that opportunity. Plus, because you can start managing relationships that are micropayments, lower costs, we'll actually be able to more cost effectively get, you know, payments and value and transactions to people that otherwise wouldn't be able to. So for one example, of course, is the remittance market. So if you've ever talked to people who send money, you know, to Nigeria, Dominican Republic, or any country, you know, they're paying anywhere from 8% to 20% fees because of Western Union and all these things. Well, if all of that's eliminated and the money actually goes all the way back directly to their relatives, you've already improved those lives measurably simply by giving them a more value for that's being transferred, as opposed to by cutting out the middleman. So those are just a couple examples that come to mind, but I'm sure Josh has a few others that he could talk to.
Yeah, love it. I mean, I totally agree. Just to build on that, I mean, the way that I heard it put recently, we actually, Clint hosted a really cool sort of symposium here in Chicago for a bunch of people in the blockchain and crypto space. A lot of academics from Northwestern University and University of Chicago participated. And what someone made this really great point, which was that, you know, and when, as technology develops, it's like you don't want to, it's just the part, it's all iterative. It's not, you don't want to pass judgment on something and say, oh, this was bad or this was a horrible mistake. It's just kind of like, sometimes there are unintended consequences as us humans continue to try to innovate. You try things, you figure out what works, what doesn't work, and then you try to fix the things that don't work. The problem that we're all dealing with, and it's seeped over into politics, and you see it in our whole, everything that's going on in like the zeitgeist of today, is that Internet 2.0, which Jeremy just talked about with Facebook and Google, and the fact that the underlying value is created from network effects. The problem with Internet 2.0 was that it accidentally created a situation where, as network effects grew, it actually caused a centralization of power and wealth with like Google, Facebook, Amazon, right? And those, and therefore these Silicon Valley titans who controlled the center node of those networks. So the problem with Internet 2.0 effectively then, and you could argue even 1.0, which was really just kind of the beginnings of e-commerce and email and you know, the ability to surf the internet, right? Is that it centralized power and therefore creates massive wealth imbalances. But what Internet 3.0, i.e. the blockchain innovation is it's basically fixing that problem by now decentralizing power and essentially taking back and then breaking that power up. And so I would also argue that anyone who believes that Adam Smith was a really smart guy and that believes in capitalism and free markets and the inevitable historical truth that it has lifted humanity's overall situation more so than any other idea that's ever come out by humanity, they would then also want to support the decentralizing efforts, because that occur with the blockchain innovation. So by breaking up these nodes of power and decentralizing them, inherently it's going to lift up all of humanity. This same concept, albeit you have to kind of, you know, I know we, I even have my own doubts around my trust of the source. But if you were listening at all to the Senate hearings with Facebook about the launch of Libra, you know, it was really fascinating. But if you and some people, I've heard people argue that the Libra white paper is kind of it's a little smoke and mirrors ish. It's like a little marketing slick, but maybe light on hardcore technical details. That's at least what a lot of the serious hardcore kind of blockchain enthusiasts have said. But nevertheless, I will say that on the more soft side of things, I think they did a really good job of articulating what it is that they're trying to achieve with Libra, and that is really about banking the world's unbanked and bringing a huge percentage of the world's population into the global financial system and giving them an opportunity to essentially participate in, you will call it, the developed world economy. So I think that this started with your question of, will this democratize wealth? And I think the answer is absolutely.
Yeah, I'll throw one more thing just to sort of build on that. I think Josh hit on a key point with the banking the unbanked. There are 2 billion people in the world who don't have a bank account. So they can't, even if they make beautiful shirts and rugs and whatever, they can't get on eBay. They can't get on Amazon because they don't have a bank account. They don't have a credit card. But they can get on, for example, an open, permissionless, decentralized, blockchain-based, that's like a lot of jargon in one, platform like Open Bazaar, and sell things. And I bought my wife a pair of earrings from a woman in rural India and I paid for it in Bitcoin. And, you know, it showed up and my wife loves them, and it cost me basically the equivalent of $12. But here's a woman who doesn't have a bank account, but now, because of this technology, can offer her products for sale to anybody, anywhere, and get paid with basically no fees. And she doesn't have to. And oh, by the way, her information isn't tracked and what have you. So her privacy is guaranteed at the same time. So, yes, I see a tremendous opportunity for that to really improves people's lives immeasurably. And I think that's what's really challenging for a lot of people in, you know, Western democracies, is they're not aware of the pain and the challenges for all these people. And I was actually in the South Bronx the other day at a seminar for high school students who are looking at trying to use cryptocurrencies within the South Bronx, because the number of unbanked people in the South Bronx alone makes it a very attractive opportunity. So it's not just in third world countries. There are people who are 2 miles from Wall Street who are excluded from the financial system and now have an opportunity to explore alternatives that can make their lives and their families' lives better.
Well, and in fact, Wall Street people and regulators and politicians, the traditional members of the traditional financial system, when talking about Libra, have said it could be dangerous. It could destabilize certain, some currencies around the world. Is that just a bunch of BS? People trying to defend their territory? How does Libra destabilize anything?
Well, yeah, that's just a lack of understanding. I mean, so according to the Libra white paper, it's actually it's going to be a fully reserved cryptocurrency that's backed by a basket of the world's biggest fiat currencies, a mixture of the US dollar, the euro, the yen, and the Swiss franc. So, I mean, that's just nonsense. That's just not, or better yet, just someone who doesn't understand, who hasn't read anything. I don't see that. Now, with that being said, if you're a true true blue, say, you know, Bitcoin, libertarianish, you know, although I hesitate to throw that word out because, you know, I myself find that I'm kind of a fan of the people's coin as well. I think where the danger lies is an example that Jeremy just gave. So when he paid the woman in India for the earrings in Bitcoin, and there was a key phrase he added there, which was that no one could then track, no one could like track that or there is not this, you know, there was not this like big brother censor over it. Right. That's a key point because the concern to me with Libra is that it's like Facebook already knows a lot about us. Now we're basically going to trust Facebook to know about everything that we've spent on.
Yeah,
when people start using Libra coin, which they will, both in the Facebook app and in the WhatsApp app and also in Instagram. And, you know, I'm a heavy Instagram user and, you know, like I'm getting ads now all the time. Now you can click directly and start buying stuff directly in Instagram. Of course, now what's going to happen is you're going to start paying for it in Libra. So now what's going to happen is, Facebook's now going to know about every single thing I've spent on. And I'm not really sure how comfortable I am with that. So that I recognize, that I'll acknowledge is, to me, a little problematic about it. But I think on the other hand, I'll also say that I think a lot of people don't care, or they just do trust big corporations. And that's what I was kind of saying earlier, is that I think where I kind of see things falling out is that I want to have a diversified set of essentially trusts that I'm doling out. I'm going to have some trust still in the U.S. government as a state actor. So I will own a lot of things in U.S. dollars and I'll hold U.S. dollars. I may or may not trust Facebook or some other corporation and their particular currency. I might transact in that currency, but I'm always going to be holding Bitcoin because that's the only one true people's coin that isn't controlled by some centralized power.
Well, you mentioned the people's coin, so let's think about this. I have not looked, but I am almost certain that if I did a little searching of YouTube videos or a little Googling, I would find the conspiracy theorists who would be saying, we're headed towards one world currency. The Bible talked about this. We don't even know who the shadowy figure Satoshi Nakamoto is, but he's probably got a 666 on his forehead and all that. Kind of, the kind of conspiracy stuff that has really permeated every level of society these days. Is there, to begin with, is there potential for a one world currency? And you know, what's wrong with a one world currency? If we had one world currency, then the arbitrage between different currencies would cease to exist. But I'm not sure that that's necessarily a bad thing if we've got one currency and we don't have China and the U.S. slapping each other silly over currency manipulation and all kinds of other allegations. What about that?
I think there definitely is a possibility for a one world currency, but that it's not guaranteed by any stretch, and there's a possibility for multiple currencies. I could see any of those scenarios playing out. The most ardent Bitcoin people within the industry are known as the Bitcoin maximalists, or the one chain to rule them all is sort of their motto. And their basic argument is that, especially today, given everything we're seeing with the absolute degradation of trust in institutions and entities worldwide, that the single most important thing we need as a global society, which of course we are at this stage, is a rock solid, immutable, non-negotiable, indisputable layer of trust about who owns what at what time. And that, in their mind, is the Bitcoin blockchain. And so once you have that layer, and Bitcoin is designed specifically for maximum security and maximum trust, that once you have that layer, then you can build all types of things on top of that. So, you know, that is their view, and that, you know, and many of them would argue that we've seen ongoing evidence that financial systems or bankers and politicians eventually kind of align to kind of keep the people happy. And there, you know, you could look at the events of the last week. I'm not a global macroeconomist by any stretch, but with the Fed lowering rates, and now New Zealand and India and Thailand and all these people, you could see that these currency manipulation battles are already underway, and that can make some people, you know, very nervous. I'm getting a little bit out of my wheelhouse here, but you know, there is that scenario where people say, "Look, I want to have one asset that I know is value is accepted everywhere, and that can't be changed unless, you know, a majority of the people in the network say we would like to increase the supply, and most people are not going to do that because it's not in their interests." So
exactly. So cryptocurrency is not tulips in Holland, is what you guys are saying. This is not some phenomenon that's suddenly going to explode in people's faces. It's not going to vaporize. It's technology based. It solves a lot of problems, Mike.
The tulips went up and then crashed and never came back. Every time Bitcoin goes up, it goes back down, but then it keeps coming back. And if you look, zoom out over the last 10 years, and you'll see these ongoing peaks and valleys. But one thing that's really interesting is the chart keeps moving up and to the right. So it's not a one and done thing. Bubbles blow up and they don't come back. If you know, most people don't remember the great crash of Bitcoin from $100 back to $10, right? Because nobody knew about it then. They didn't remember the 1,000 back to the, you know, 150. They don't remember those because they didn't know about it. They're just aware of, oh, it was at 20,000 and went down to 3. That's true. But that volatility, in my opinion, is just a reflection of the relative immaturity and, as Josh said, the nascent industry that we're in. This is, you know, your three-year-old is volatile because it's still, you know, maturing. But at a certain point, that volatility smoothed out, you know? So Bitcoin is a 10-year-old, basically. 10-year-olds sometimes are volatile, but eventually, as more and more people adopt it. And you can see this. The fact that we're having this conversation and there are people who are genuinely interested in Bitcoin, 4 years ago when I got into this industry, none of them had heard of it. And now all of them have. And some of them.
Yeah, they thought you were bipolar at the time, and now they know you're a sane human being. I love the analogy of the 3-year-old, the 10-year-old, the maturation process that has to take place. I got to tell you, gentlemen, this has been a very interesting discussion. You've definitely clarified some things for me, and I trust that you've clarified some things for our listeners. Let me just give each of you a chance just to make a parting observation or two. Is there what would you leave our listeners with, just in terms of, you've already given a lot of information, a lot of perspective here, but just in parting, any final perspective or piece of information that you'd like to leave with us?
Mine would just be that, you know, a quick story that sometimes I like to tell about, like, it's kind of like what I'll call the way in which humans adapt and the way we adapt to change. In my own life, my story around what I've seen with technology since I was a kid, it relates to my dad, who is, you know, an amazing guy, and I love him very much, and he's a big, and you know, he uses a lot of these technologies. But here's kind of the story. Was like, I remember when we first got our computer when I was and I think I was in maybe 7th, 8th grade or something like that, the very first computer we got. It was a Leading Edge, you know, one with like floppy disks and MS-DOS. And then I remember there was this thing called America Online, and you ordered it and it came and there was like a disc, right? And you had to upload it, and we went through the modem and it did that sound, you know, with the dial up and everything. And then you'd say, I remember my dad said, "There's no way that people are going to, this whole email thing is kind of cute." He's like, "But there's no way that people are going to actually want to send anything sensitive over electronic mail." they're just going to continue. I mean, obviously that's ridiculous. They're going to have to keep using, like, they're going to use FedEx and they're all, you know, serious documents. Well, okay. So we know how that turned out. Then I remember, you know, like this thing called Amazon came out and yeah, I was like, oh, hey dad, you can order books on the internet now. And he's like, that's ridiculous. People are going to want to, people want to feel and touch their book and they want to have a nice cup of coffee at Borders, you know? And well, we see what's happened with Borders. We see what's happened with Amazon. Then this thing came out, like, after, you know, Blockbuster went out of business, there was this company Netflix, and we ordered the CD, we ordered the DVDs to watch, and they would come in the mail. And then eventually at some point, I said to my dad, hey, guess what? Netflix now has streaming service. We can actually watch these movies on the internet. And my dad was like, that's ridiculous. The pipes of the internet are not big enough for a movie to go through it. So, you know, and so at each stage, my, you know, and this is just within the last, like, what, you know, 30 years, at each stage, my dad thought all these innovations were ridiculous. And then each of them have come to pass. So we've talked a lot today about the idea of, like, a global currency, a global, a people's coin, some sort of a stable value. We've talked a lot about what blockchain, the actual blockchain innovation can do to solve so many problems. We've talked about, you know, not paying $85 for an international wire, instead paying 4 cents and getting it in 10 seconds. You know, all these things my dad or anyone else would have said were completely ridiculous and impossible. And each of them has and continue to will come to pass. And so what I would say is that for any, you know, I've seen, there's a lot of people that are talking about it, but I see a very little action still. And I come back to where we started this thing, which is that for anyone to not invest at least 1% of their investable assets into this space, you're going to just be absolutely kicking yourself later on down the road if you don't do it. So anyway, that would be my parting thought.
Interesting. Jeremy?
Yeah, Josh is, he's more of a believer than I am, and I'm pretty hardcore. So no, I mean, I agree. And my life history has been a series of people telling me, oh, I'll never use email. I'll never feel comfortable putting my credit card online. I'll never need a smartphone. At this stage of the game, I just say, look, you know, I've been studying crypto now for 4 years. And I can't tell you with 100% certainty that it's going to work. But there's no way you can tell me with 100% certainty that it's not going to work. And it's just, for that alone, and based on what we've seen, I agree. That's the premise of our fund is, look, don't be an idiot. Hedge yourself, put a little bit on it, and, you know, we'll do our best to find the value for you. But this is a big deal, and it's worth paying attention to when it's early, because by the time everyone else realizes it, you know, the opportunity is gone. So yeah, that would be my advice. And, you know, good luck in your study of the subject, because it is exciting. It is scary. It is a new paradigm. I totally understand that. But as Josh pointed out, and you talked about it along the way, Mike, these paradigms happen, they change, and they start to change faster and faster. And so we're just here to tell you, we think this is a pretty significant one worth paying attention to.